Hello and welcome to Talking Tudors, a fortnightly podcast about the ever-fascinating Tudor dynasty. My name is Natalie Gruniger and I'll be your host and guide on this journey through 16th century England. Are you ready to step through the veil of time into the dazzling and dangerous world of the Tudor court? Without further ado, it's time to talk Tudors. Everyone, welcome back to Talking Tudors, episode 8. I'm your host, Natalie Gruniger, and joining me today to talk about pilgrimage in medieval and Tudor England and sacred sites of the time is Dr. Emma Wells. Emma is an ecclesiastical and architectural historian based at the University of York, specialising in pilgrimage, the cult of saints, and the census of late medieval and early modern England. Pilgrim Roots of the British Isles was published in 2016, and her next book, Heaven on Earth, The Life and Legacies of the World's Greatest Cathedrals, is due to be published in 2020. My conversation with Emma straight after this short musical break, courtesy of guitarist John Sales. Welcome to Talking Tudors, Emma. Please tell us a little bit about yourself and your background.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me, first of all. Well, I am an ecclesiastical and architectural historian based at the University of York. I specialise in pilgrimage and the cult of saints, particularly the sort of later medieval Reformation era particularly, and I sort of look at everything from, as I say, pilgrimage to cultural rivalry to the senses, really. Those are my sort of particular areas of expertise.
Okay, wonderful. And I'd love it if you could talk to us a little bit about the history of pilgrimage and also touch on the tradition of pilgrimage in the late medieval and maybe Tudor times.
Yeah, well, throughout the sort of the Middle Ages, Christians sought to close the distance between themselves and God by engaging in physical travel towards a spiritual goal. That was the sort of aim. So such journeys served a variety of functions. From, so they might set out for a particular goal, it might be to fulfill a vow as an atonement of sins, to seek a miraculous cure, gesture of thanks, whatever it might be, or even just a holiday.
Right.
and by the 4th century, pilgrimage had become a sort of recognised expression of piety, and that was through to the zenith of pilgrimage by, you know, the 12th century, was that was when it was really at the height.
Right, okay.
And so the practice revolved around visiting either sites significant in the Bible. So that's sort of what we started with, so particularly those concerning the life of Christ. And then we move on to the lives of the saints, to those sorts of places, and paying reverence to holy relics. And as a result, the acquisition of relics for pilgrims to visit was vital to the income of the church, because it was believed that the possession of saintly relics therefore increased a church's spiritual authenticity. So parish churches, monasteries and cathedrals, therefore, the more relics they had, therefore the more pilgrims would come to visit the relics, and therefore the more pilgrims they would get for the door, the more cash they had. And then so we had about Jerusalem, Rome, Santiago de Compostela in northern Spain. They were sort of the main three later medieval pilgrimage sites in the sort of the Zenith era, really.
Right, okay. And what did the people of the time actually believe about the power of these relics and about miracles as well?
Well, they believed that physical remains of a holy person, or really any objects with which they'd touched, they'd come into contact with, were imbued with the sanctity of that person. Mm. That's the sort of the gist of it. So relics were more than simply mementos. And even the New Testament refers to the power of objects that were touched by Christ and his apostles, in fact. So the body of the saint therefore provided a spiritual link between life and death, between man and God. So the saints and anything they had touched were intercessors of sanctity, if you will.
Okay.
So the journey to a shrine to touch the holy bones or the tomb or anything related to that saint, therefore brought the devotee physically and concretely within the scope of the saint's power and patronage. And therefore, as we go on throughout the Middle Ages, the veneration of relics came to rival the sacraments in the daily life of the medieval church. So, and indeed, actually, from the time of Charlemagne, it was obligatory that every altar contain a relic.
Right, okay. Oh, that's so interesting. Now, I was in York earlier this year, in April, actually, and I visited the Bar Combat Museum. Have you been there?
I have indeed, yes.
Yeah, it's great, isn't it? And I was shown a pretty grisly relic. So this one's associated with Margaret Clitheroe that lived in York. It was her severed hand. And I was just wondering, what are some of the more sort of bizarre relics that you've come across in your research?
Christ's foreskin, perhaps. Oh, is that bizarre enough?
Gosh, where is that? That's very interesting. Yeah.
Well, yes, it's also known as the Holy Prepuce. So the early historical appearance of Jesus's foreskin came when Charlemagne presented it to Pope Leo II in 800. So it's said that when the young Christ was circumcised, his foreskin was preserved. And in the Middle Ages, it became a much coveted relic. Right. And several churches claimed to own part or all of it. So, interesting.
That is I haven't heard of that one. That is quite a bizarre one.
It is. And Saint Bridget, it gets more interesting. Okay. Saint Bridget claimed that she had orgasms when bits of foreskin were dropped on her tongue by an angel.
Oh, okay. There you go. There's another story on it.
Well, let's not speak of her. And however, the various relics of it were discredited by the end of the 18th century. And by the 20th century, it actually became a little bit of an embarrassment to the church. And the last known claimant was stolen in 1983 in Calcutta. So it's an interesting tale.
That is an interesting story, yes. Gosh, all right. Now, so both Henry VIII and Catherine of Aragon went on pilgrimage to Walsingham. Catherine, we know, visited at least four times in 1515, 1517, 1519, and 1521. I was wondering if you could tell us a bit about the significance of this particular site.
Yeah, well, the North Norfolk village of Walsingham was the site of the 11th century shrine of the Virgin Mary, and it's sort of England's self-branded, England's Nazareth, as it were. Right. And even to this day, actually, 250,000 pilgrims are said to visit it annually, so that just shows even how popular it is today.
Wow. Yeah.
And although we sort of talk about Walsingham, there are actually quite a few sites of reverence around it, but when we talk of the shrine, we actually mean really the village of Little Walsingham, which is between the city of Norwich and the town of King's Lynn. Mm-hmm. And the significance of it derives from 1061, when the widow of the Lord of the Manor of Walsingham, Parva, Ricaldis, he had a vision of the Virgin Mary. Mm-hmm. And Mary took Ricaldis in spirit to Nazareth to show her the place where the angel Gabriel had appeared to her. And Ricaldis was told to take note of the measurements of the Holy House and build a copy of it in Walsingham.
Right.
But her son Geoffrey then left instructions in his will for a priory to be built around the Holy House, which was undertaken by the Augustinians in the mid-12th century. Mm-hmm. And the workmen tried to build there, but they found themselves unable to do so they gave up in despair and consulted Ricaldis. The next morning, the chapel was found fully completed, and it was concluded that the Virgin Mary had obviously removed the Holy House to the place she had chosen, hence this is the Walsingham legend, you see.
Right.
So ever since, it has been venerated as one of the holiest places in England. Mm. And in fact, by the later Middle Ages, it was the duty of every Englishman to visit the Shrine of Our Lady during his lifetime. Mm. So we see pretty much all of the royals visiting throughout the medieval era, even into the Tudor era. Well, obviously Henry VIII and his wives as well. And in fact, there were so many people wanting to make pilgrimages there that the church had to regulate practices so that families and work were not neglected. You had to get permission from your bishop.
Right, okay.
So that's just how popular it was. But the shrine itself, there was an image shrine, and then we also had the Slipper Chapel, which was about a mile south of Walsingham. And this is the primary Catholic shrine, which is still there, which was built around 1340. Mm. And it's the last pilgrim chapel before the village. It's the only surviving station of many that once marked the actual pilgrim route to Walsingham. Right. And its unusual name derives from the fact that the pilgrims would remove their shoes here to walk barefoot the rest of the way from the chapel into Walsingham itself. And it's, as I say, it's still a Catholic shrine, which was restored in, I think it was the 1930s as well.
Okay, and is it connected to like fertility or something along those lines?
Oh, of course, a lot of them are as well, yes. And there's also the Holy Well, which is still there too, so which is believed to have many of the healing properties still, absolutely.
Okay, yeah. And what were some of the other sort of major pilgrimage sites in the early, pre-Reformation Tudor times?
Obviously, we have Canterbury, which was one of the most popular. In England, it was the most popular. Well, between Canterbury and Durham, there was a huge rivalry, which was part of my research. I'm looking at this.
Right.
But Canterbury was one of the most popular throughout the Middle Ages, and it's due to the fact, obviously, Archbishop Thomas Becket was murdered in the northwest transept of the cathedral in 1170 by the Knights of Henry II. Mm-hmm. And he was declared a saint less than 3 years later. So, because of that, pilgrims flocked to his tomb very, very quickly, and miracles abound that the holy water of St. Thomas, which was essentially holy water, mixed with the blood that was mopped up from his seeping head wound, essentially, as he lay there, was miraculous very soon after his murder. So, so pilgrims went to his tomb, which was in the crypt, and then, which was very interesting, about 1174, so 4 years after his death, there was a dramatic fire in the east end of the cathedral, which you may think, oh, that's a terrible thing, but actually it happened to be very beneficial to the cathedral, as they got to build a shiny new east end of the cathedral and a shiny new shrine for St. Thomas Becket.
Right.
So it actually turned out to be beneficial, and it's very interesting. Was it arson, in fact? So that's quite interesting. So he had a shiny new shrine, very magnificent shrine with jewels, marble slab, etc. And it was so popular, in fact, that 100,000 pilgrims visited in the year after his death, with donations valuing the equivalent of 16 million today. We also have, I thought I would just say, a lesser known site, but it was very popular in the Middle Ages, which was Boxley in Kent, which was the famous Shrine of the Rood.
Okay.
The cross was said to have been carved by an English carpenter who constructed a working model of the crucifix. So it had wires and strings, which was worked from behind, and it allowed the eyes to move and the mouth to open, and the hands moved in the gesture of blessing. But so the model reached Boxley, but a horse carrying it bolted, and the cross, which was once at the monastery, it became immovable as a result of this accident, and it became a shrine. However, as a result, it became extremely, extremely popular for pilgrims to visit. And in fact, in the 1380s, there's a will that refers to it as one of the most important shrines besides Walsingham. And there are records of very important visitors. Cardinal Campeggio spent a night there. And by the 15th century, the abbey was styled the Abbey of the Holy Cross of Grace. And in the early 16th century, Archbishop Wareham wrote to Cardinal Wolsey that it was so holy a place that many miracles be showed there. So we don't know this, but it was one of the most popular.
I haven't heard of that one before, so that's interesting.
Yeah.
And so what effect did the Reformation have on pilgrimage and holy places?
Well, I suppose we often think that it was entirely eradicated, but actually this wasn't the case. The first significant prescriptions on pilgrimages took place through the Henrician royal injunctions of 1536. And these pronounced, obviously, against superstitious beliefs on pilgrimages, relics and images. So they were essentially banished. And then we had the 1538 injunctions, which ordered the removal of images, marriages, burials, placing in churches of a large Bible. So essentially all associated superstitious destructions or fantasies of idolatry, as William of Grey termed it, as I think it's a wonderful phrase. But simply anything that was thought to create an inappropriate setting for worship, which pilgrimages and the cult of saints really was at this time. And so intermediaries, the saints, was no longer required, and all memory was of them was gone. The need to journey to them was gone.
Yeah.
But the essential nature of pilgrimage, so making a journey to a sacred site, remained a powerful metaphor, I suppose, for Christians. And the deep-rooted beliefs didn't simply vanish overnight, which I suppose, you know, if you have a deep-rooted belief, it simply wouldn't be. It wouldn't be for us today. And so this pilgrimage essentially did go on. So what we actually see then is quite a great upsurge in pilgrimage activity occurring across Europe. Mm-hmm. Much of this was to local shrines, often even newly created shrines. Another destination we see lots of pilgrims going was to Rome.
Right.
So essentially the sense of loss promoted religious nostalgia. For example, we have the investigations in the Diocese of Canterbury in the 1540s revealed that a few pilgrims there, I'm sure he's called Edward Dingwall, in Kent, had spent 2 years away from home, apparently pilgrimaging to Walsingham. Mm-hmm. And in the 1580s in Northamptonshire, again, we see people going to Canterbury again to visit the holy places there. So I think, again, it proved hard to eradicate this belief in the aura attached to the special places. And then from then on, the continuing power of pilgrimages could be seen in the work of a lot of post-Reformation writers. So we have The Passionate Man's Pilgrimage, attributed to Sir Walter Raleigh. Mm-hmm. And again, we have John Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress, published in 1678, which portrays the journey through life of a representative figure who leaves his home to seek the celestial city. So it then became about more of a metaphorical pilgrimage in order to journey through life and better oneself through the, you know, the soul's journey. So it continued on. And then we get to the sort of 18th and 19th century, and it starts again.
Yeah, and there's quite a revival now, isn't there, of people?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. Now, I was just thinking, during the 1535 Royal Progress, Henry and Anne Boleyn go on Progress, and I know that during that Progress, Anne in particular sent out a couple of her chaplains to investigate one of the relics, and I'm trying to think, I think it was Hales Abbey, possibly. Do we see more of that? Do we see more of people questioning the authenticity of certain relics around the time of, you know, the Reformation and that sort of point?
Oh, I think absolutely. And we have that even before. I mean, if you think to sort of even the Canterbury Tales, you have the pig bones and that. I mean, that was going on far before. And there's many instances of duck's blood coming up as some relics, and many, many bones were found to be animal bones. So that was going on throughout. But what's interesting is, does it matter? Did it matter? Mm. Or was it more about the representation, the thing in itself, the saint itself, the image itself, and what it meant as a whole, what the experience meant as a whole?
Yeah.
But indeed, this was going on from the early 1500s, I would say, yes.
Right, so okay.
And then that is the beginning of it, really. You know, that's absolutely. And the beginning of the Reformation, that was, you know, Luther's point, I suppose, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Fantastic. Now, you've written a really fantastic book on pilgrim routes of the British Isles, and I know you're currently working on a book about the world's greatest cathedrals. I was just wondering if you wouldn't mind sharing with us a few of your favourites.
A few of my favourite cathedrals, to start with.
Yes, please.
Yeah. Well, what I found, actually, writing the book, which is Heaven on Earth, is actually the very interesting tales. What I'm focusing on is the interesting tales of their construction. So one of the most fantastic ones is the story of the Hagia Sophia, which is absolutely fascinating. And it actually commences in the Constantinople Hippodrome in the year 532.
Right.
When during a chariot race, two main rival fan groups joined forces in protest against Emperor Justinian I. Mm-hmm. And with the support of senators, it turned into the most violent insurrection in the history of Constantinople. And much of the city centre was destroyed. Many thousands of people were actually left for dead.
Oh, goodness. I
know. And after the riot, Justinian was eager to restore his authority. He stood amid the ruins of the cathedral that had just burnt to the ground in this riot and vowed before his people to build a church that would far surpass anything seen before. And his divine masterpiece was therefore completed in less than 6 years. And that was a sort of redemption story.
Right.
And I wasn't really aware of the story before, you know, even researching the Hagia Sophia. And there are a lot of stories like this. And I think I find it extremely interesting.
Definitely.
In fact, York Minster is very similar, that there are sort of, it featured countless disasters and misfortunes, which wreaked havoc on its fabric. For example, in 1829, a religious fanatic named Jonathan Martin did his best to burn it to the ground, and hadn't been the first to try. But as a result, we found the crypt, the Norman crypt, the undiscovered Norman crypt, so that was fascinating. But another of my favourites is Notre Dame de Paris.
Oh, yes.
And the reason that this is a favourite is its inherent secret mathematical code.
Oh.
And during the construction, at the turn of the 12th century, the Chancellor composed the Historia Scholastica. And in it, he fixates on a passage in the Old Testament, and it's a detailed description of the Temple of Solomon, or, you know, God's house on earth. And the manuscript reveals that to the builders of Notre Dame, its dimensions were profoundly important. So it's 30 cubits to the first level and 60 cubits to the second level.
Right.
I know, which doesn't mean a lot, but what the numbers mean is that they're literally built into the structure, but are they purely coincidental?
Right.
Or did the builders intentionally encode sacred numbers from the Bible into their cathedrals? And we find this across medieval cathedrals. We find this in the east window of York Minster. In fact, there's 144 panels, which is, you know, a very sacred number. So I find it extremely, extremely fascinating. And then finally, I have Saint-Denis in France, which is another favourite, which is essentially where we get Gothic from. It's the birth of Gothic.
Right, okay.
Built in 1144, and essentially it's where most of the kings and queens of Paris, of France, were buried. But Abbot Suger, who's the visionary behind it, he created a building which was brilliantly coloured glass. There's so much glass in there, which we didn't have before. The light streamed through these enormous windows, and we have impossibly slender walls. And this type of architecture and architectural combination was revolutionary. He termed it modern. Critics scoffed and derisively referred to it after the barbarians known as the Goths. The name stuck.
Right, okay.
This is where we get Gothic.
Wow, that's so interesting, isn't it? I love all the stories, to do with that. That's great. Now, have you travelled to all the cathedrals that you're writing about, or most of them? Or?
I have some, and I'm in the midst of travelling. So
yes. When's the book coming out?
That's a good question.
Oh, you're still, okay, so you don't have
I'm still writing. It'll be a couple of years, but it's coming on as soon as possible, hopefully.
Oh, yes. Exciting, that's really exciting. All right, Emma, well, it's time for us to play 10 to go. So 10 quick questions, are you ready?
I'm ready.
Are you ready? Excellent, good. So what do you like to do to recharge?
To recharge, usually a bath and a good book.
Yeah, that sounds lovely, actually. What's something that brings you joy? I think I know one of the things, cathedrals.
Cathedrals, yes, and visiting historical sites, I suppose.
Oh, yes, me too, totally. What's one of your favourite holiday destinations?
Oh, that's a tricky one. I'm going to cheat a little, but because I have two. But I think the French or Italian Riviera.
So. Oh, beautiful. Nice choice. Describe your ideal Saturday night.
I think it would have to be a nice drive into the countryside, a beautiful meal, come back home with, I don't know, a box set, a bath, and that's pretty much
that
it.
That sounds
really
pretty good. What does your writing space look like?
Well, it's in the midst of being created.
Oh, that's right. Good. You've got some renovations, yes.
I have, but it's going to be all bookcases, you know, walls and walls of bookcases. Oh, and I have a lovely Victorian desk, an open fire, Victorian cast iron fire.
That's so nice.
Yes, and a window in front of me. Yeah.
Oh, that sounds beautiful. You'll have to show us a photo when it's all done and ready.
I will.
Sounds good. What books, or what's one of the books that's currently on your bedside table?
Well, I've just started reading Dan Jones and Marina Amaral's Colour of Time. I've just got that through. It's fantastic.
That really looks revolutionary. Amazing.
It is.
Well, I'll have to add that onto my very long list of books that I need to get.
Another one, actually, I must just say, I was reviewing it for the TLS, but Decca Warrington, her reimagining of the Eleanor Crosses.
Okay.
It's a great fact meets fictional tale. It's sort of an epic love story of Eleanor of Castile and Edward I, and
his
memorials of the Eleanor Crosses. But it's a really different book, but it's quite short, so it's a great sort of Saturday night read.
Yeah, that sounds great. What's a new skill that you'd like to learn?
A new skill? I have a couple.
Yep, you can give us more than one.
French, hopefully I will do that. I have my best friend who's French. I used to play the flute, so I'd like to get going and take up that again. And photography, with photographing to churches, I would like to master the art of photography.
Yeah, fantastic. That sounds good. What's your favourite form of exercise?
Well, I do have a personal trainer.
Good.
I've been trying to do good, so yoga is certainly my favourite. I love yoga.
It is good. Have you been doing it for long?
Since, because I was very unwell last year, so I decided to start this year. But I sort of did it before, but I've really got into it. I've been doing it for years and years, but really got into it this year.
Oh, that's fantastic. It's so good for you, isn't it?
Yes.
Are you a sweet or a savoury person?
Oh, I think most people will call me sweet. Yes.
And lucky last question. What's the first word that comes to mind when I say Henry VIII?
Revolutionary.
I like it. Okay. I thought you might say something like codpiece or something like that. I think that came to mind when I thought of him. But that's okay. All right. Thank you. Revolutionary. That's excellent. Now, listeners will know that I ask all guests at the end of the episodes if they can leave us with a Tudor takeaway, something for us to explore after the episode. So, Emma, what's your Tudor takeaway?
Well, I would say the Gresham lectures are one of my Tudor takeaways. They're not just Tudor associated, but they have some great Tudor ones. So the Gresham Lecturers are a series that you can find. If you just Google the Gresham Lecturers, you will find it. But particularly those by Professor Simon Thirley, as I'm an architecture as well as a theatrical historian, they're a real hidden gem, a gold mine of information.
Love it.
And you can watch them as well as download the transcriptions. And there's everything on there, from the politics of architecture in Tudor and Stuart London to painting, patronage and politics under the Tudors. So a real mix of everything Tudor's under there. Book-wise, I would also say probably Eamon Duffy's Stripping of the Altars and his Voices of Morbath, because if anyone wants to know why I got into what I did, read those, because you will understand sort of lay people's experience of religion, how the Reformation really got to the heart of and impacted sort of the rural world and the lay world, and the sort of crisis as the Reformation progressed. I think they're just fantastic tomes.
Fantastic. I'm loving these Tudor takeaways. My list is just getting longer every day. Books.
Very expensive list.
Yeah, very expensive list. Yeah. That's fantastic. Thank you so much for joining me on Talking Tudors, Emma. I really look forward to hopefully speaking to you again once, your next book's out or sooner than that even.
Great. Thank you very much for having me. It was wonderful.
Thank you. Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Talking Tudors. Thank you so much for listening. If you have any comments or suggestions, or just want to say hi, please get in touch with me via my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, where you will also find show notes for today's episode. If you've enjoyed the show, please share the podcast with friends and family and click on the all-important follow button so you'll never miss an episode. I also invite you to join our Talking Tudors podcast group on on Facebook, where you can interact with other Tudor history lovers and hear all the behind-the-scenes news. It's time now for us to re-enter the modern world. As always, I look forward to talking Tudors with you again very soon.